Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Hi, Mom, I'm home, George called out, the front door slamming behind him. He dumped his books on the nearest chair. His mom was sitting by the window in her wheelchair looking out at the desk. She replied. I wonder when you'd be home. Sorry, he kissed her forehead. You want a drink or something?
That would be nice, she responded.
George put a tall glass of ice water in her hand and sat down with a bottle of soda. I just had a quickie pickup game of basketball with the guys. They needed me. I didn't think you'd mind.
I don't mind, his mom began. But since I can't come and get you, she looked at him meaningfully, I do worry when you're not home on time.
Well, I'm here now, George stood up. So let's talk about dinner. What would you like?
Oh, I don't know, his mom sighed. But before you get to that, could you collect the light-colored laundry and throw in a load? I guess we need to go over the grocery list, too, since we're probably out of some things you'll want for school lunches. Now, if you can help me on with my brace, maybe I can look into the fridge and see what we've got to work with. Oh, and while you're collecting the laundry, could you please grab my blue pills from the dresser?
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about kids caring for disabled parents? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has been working with caregiving services for many years. Gail Gibson Hunt is president and CEO of the National Alliance for Caregiving, a nonprofit coalition dedicated to conducting research and developing national programs for family caregivers and the professionals who serve them. Prior to this, she was president of her own aging services consulting firm for 14 years. She conducted corporate elder care research for the National Institute on Aging and the Social Security Administration, developed training for caregivers with AARP and the American Occupational Therapy Association, and designed a corporate elder care program with the Employee Assistance Professional Association. Gail is the mother of a grown son and a college-aged daughter. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Gail.
Thank you so much.
What's the most important thing you'd want to tell a youngster helping to care for a disabled parent?
It's very difficult for kids when they're caring for a parent with a disability. They typically will feel isolated. They may not have time for the activities that other kids have. George, in your example, was the exception, actually, who got to play the pickup game. Most kids will come home and will be very involved and actually be the primary caregiver for this parent or grandparent. They will actually be doing all of these tasks, the household tasks, such as you mentioned, the grocery shopping, the sometimes transportation if they're old enough to drive, taking mom to the doctor's, helping to do the housework, meals, and that sort of thing. But over and above that, they often will be involved in personal care tasks, bathing, dressing, feeding, helping to toilet their parents, or transferring them from a bed to a wheelchair or a wheelchair to the bathtub. So they're involved in these tasks and they can be very stressful. So what you want the kids to know is they're not alone, first of all, and that secondly, if they need help with adjusting to school, with dealing with these problems, that they should talk to their parents or their grandparents' physician or the nurse in the physician's office or somebody at the school, either a guidance counselor or their teacher.
Can you give us a profile of these kids? Is there sort of a kind of sense of what these kids' days are like, what their weeks are like?
First of all, let's talk a little bit about the numbers, just so you know. They're between 1.3 and 1.4 million of these kids between 8 and 18 in the U.S.
Oh my God.
So this is over 3% of the kids who are taking on these tasks, typically for a parent or a grandparent, although sometimes you'll see they'll have a disabled sibling and they'll be helping to care for the disabled brother or sister as well. These are kids between 8 and 18, as I said. And you see that they take these responsibilities on typically on top of school. So we see, because we don't really have a lot of services except for really poor people, we don't have a lot of healthcare services in this country, for example, personal assistance if you have somebody with a disability. the kid actually functions in that role. So they're doing the kinds of tasks that I mentioned, including those personal care tasks, which can be very stressful. I mean, you can just imagine what it's like for a child to be having to help bathe his mother.
I can't imagine the burden of that and the emotions that that child would feel.
Exactly. Well, and what you see is you'll see that these kids typically in the younger cohorts, the younger group of kids, say 8 to 12, they are going to be somewhat more anxious, have somewhat more concerns that they're feeling isolated than children of the same age. When you see the older group, the say 12 to 18, 13 to 18, those kids, you start to see some impacts in the school. And they tend to be maybe a little more disruptive in school. Actually, there have been studies that have traced them after they're 18, and they find that they tend to drop out more, and they also tend to be unemployed more. So it can be a very stressful situation for a kid to have to deal with.
Would the unemployment be related to just not wanting responsibilities?
Part of it is they drop out of school, and it's more difficult to be employed if you've dropped out of school.
When these kids take on these responsibilities, how exactly does that work? In other words, if there's a need in a home for a parent to have this kind of help, suddenly a child is the one this falls on?
Actually, it's really horrible.
I mean, I just can't even visualize.
A parent could be in a hospital and can be discharged from the hospital with the hospital knowing that this parent is coming home to nothing more than maybe two kids. It happens all the time. It's sort of not viewed as the responsibility of the hospital to say, oh, wow, this is a single parent, and she's got these two kids, and that's it. I mean, the profile of the child who's a caregiver is they have a single mom who has MS. Mm-hmm. So that's the person and the mom isn't going to be in the hospital a lot. She may be sort of in and out. But you have to say that somebody in the doctor's office knows that this parent is a single parent and has these kids who are under 18 that she's living with and that they're the ones who are functioning as caregivers. And over and above that, the profile that you asked about earlier, we typically see that it's going to be they're living together. In other words, where there's a child caregiver, those kids are going to be living together. They're also lower income, and sometimes more often than not, they'll be minority kids. So what you're going to see is sometimes, let's say in an immigrant family, those kids are pulled out of school to go to the doctor's office with the parent so they can translate because they speak English. Mm-hmm. And think of the position that puts the child in. Not just when the doctor is asking questions of the parent, but say it's an AIDS patient. The doctor's talking about sexual behavior and the child has to translate for the doctor and for the parent. It's just a very difficult situation. Plus, the child's been pulled out of school to deal with the situation.
We'll take a short break now and we'll be right back to continue our discussion on kids caring for disabled family members.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, The Popular Voters Guide by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Gail Gibson Hunt about kids caring for disabled family members.
So in some of these cases, or maybe many of these cases, this is a progressive thing. It happens, for example, you mentioned MS or AIDS. These are things that gradually sort of take over the life of the family. They make it more and more difficult for the parent with the problem to do the things that that parent would normally do. So the child or children are gradually taking on more and more responsibility. Are they generally pretty responsible? Kids that are put in this position?
Oh, my gosh, yes, they definitely are. I mean, these children, when you talk to them, they feel as if they've taken this on. This is a major part of their lives. And they talk about it as, for example, they are sometimes embarrassed to bring friends home because they've got this parent that, in the example that you gave in the story at the beginning, you talked about how the mom was there and had needed help with her brace and she was in a wheelchair or maybe bedbound. And so they're embarrassed to bring friends home. So they do tend to feel isolated. But they also tend to feel very responsible, like someone is relying on me, which they are. Someone is, mm-hmm. the parent or the grandparent. And one thing that's interesting is that the study that we did, which was the first national study at all of these kids in the U.S., was a preliminary study. It collected data, but we didn't get to do things like tease out what are the differences between kids caring for a parent and kids helping to care for a grandparent. Mm-hmm. So you do see that there would be some differences because typically if you're caring for a grandparent, you're helping your parents care for the grandparent who probably lives with you. And you may be doing a lot of those tasks, but you're generally speaking going to be sharing them with your parent, mm-hmm. as opposed to the single mom who maybe is totally on her own. And we have heard some interesting stories. Not all of these kids come to this gradually. Some of them come to it from birth. In other words, the parents have some disability when the child is born. So the child is basically born into the situation and grows into the caregiving role. But there are stories of parents who have strokes young or who have early onset Alzheimer's, and it quite suddenly changes the circumstances of the family and the child becomes the caregiver. The thing that is very interesting to us is the fact that nobody seems to be picking up on this. Well, where are the doctors and where are the social workers?
That's what I want to know. Where are the social workers?
In hospitals, isn't there some kind of requirement that a social worker has to see the patient and the patient's family before the hospital discharges the patient?
But seeing and providing for, we've dealt with only elderly people. Mm-hmm. And my mother-in-law was hospitalized repeatedly. She was never allowed to leave the hospital till the hospital knew, the social workers mm-hmm. knew what kind of care she was going to get, who was going to be responsible for taking care of her when she left. She had to go to a rehab, or we had to have home health care people coming in to help, or whatever it was. So it seems extraordinarily irresponsible to me that an adult could be discharged to their children.
Yes, I would agree. I'll just tell you that the scenario that you've just given is actually for older people is also quite optimistic, in that hospitals all the time discharge the little old man in the care of the little old lady who weighs 90 pounds and is supposed to figure out how she's going to get him into the bathtub and out of the bathtub and all that. That happens all the time, too.
Oh, my gosh.
But you're absolutely right. But it's not just a case of discharging from the hospital. I mean, this is a longer term, mm-hmm. more of a chronic situation. And you wonder also not only about the primary care doc and the people in the primary care doc's office or the specialist's office, but you wonder about the schools. Mm-hmm. And are the schools just not picking up on the fact that there are these kids that are caregivers, and it's not an inconsequential number of kids?
That was another big surprise.
Yes.
Are there statistics about the ages of these kids? Are there more kids in a certain age group who are likely to be caregivers than other age groups, or is it so scattered that there's really no pattern?
Well, we actually saw in our study that it broke out pretty much consistently. So you had about 3 in 10 kids who were in the 8 to 11 category, 38% were 12 to 15, and 31% were 16 to 18. So it's pretty much an even breakout. But, I mean, think about that. 3 in 10 of the kids are 8 to 11.
I can't even imagine.
And actually, in the UK, where they have done lots of studies on these kids, they have kids as young as 5. I mean, they know that there are kids as young as 5. So we would figure that we would know there were kids as young as 5 doing this in our country as well. We just didn't pick them up in the study. We just focused on 8-year-olds and older.
Is this something that hits hardest, particularly in immigrant communities? You sort of touched on that a little bit.
Well, in immigrant communities, there's more of the sense, I think, of extended family and reliance on family, and then the big issue of language. But it's not that it's necessarily limited to immigrant families at all. And that's why I said the prototype is the single mom with MS, and that's not going to be limited to an immigrant person. That could be anyone. And actually, the MS Society is one of the few organizations that recognizes, over the years, has recognized that there are kids as caregivers and has started support groups for these kids in a couple of places. One other group of kids that our young caregivers were beginning to recognize are children whose parents are coming home from Iraq who have been disabled. And there's a substantial number of people these days who are living when they wouldn't have before. They come home and now they are disabled in some way, and those kids are having to deal with their parents being disabled as well.
Do those children have opportunities, did you find in your study, to go to other children's homes? How do they follow up on peer relationships?
We do know in other countries where they've focused programs on these kids that they have peer counseling and they have support groups for other young caregivers. And that's very popular among the young caregivers. At school, they'll have lunchtime support groups that they can go to with other kids so they can talk about their issues. Same as support groups for people with cancer or any other illness. Same idea. Or caregivers of any age.
I remember support groups in our children's schools for children whose parents were going through divorces.
Yes.
And they had lunchtime, you know, programs. My children had friends in those programs. And I was very impressed that right there in school they were addressing that. But it sounds like these children need so much more.
But they don't even have that. And actually, my understanding is a lot of schools now have cut back on those support programs, even for kids with divorce, that they just have had cutbacks, and so they don't have the guidance counselors who can be in the schools to host the lunchtime programs. Because my kids were in some of those programs in elementary school as well, and I know that in the same elementary schools now, they've cut back quite a bit. And in talking with the American School Guidance Association, they mentioned that it's a real issue for guidance counselors to be able to have the time to do that sort of thing.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on kids caring for disabled family members.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Gail Gibson Hunt about kids caring for disabled family members.
What advice would you give to a parent in a family where a young person is a caregiver for someone disabled?
Well, it's easy to see how a disabled parent might feel threatened by the whole notion that somebody outside recognizes that they may have some limitations in their ability to be a parent to this child. So it's very important that both the outside, whether it's a teacher or a social worker or a doctor or a nurse, understand this person is still the parent. And they probably can do a great job of parenting. They may need some support. They may need some assistance with dealing with some of the parenting issues that their child may have because of the stresses that we've talked about. But the parent is probably doing a great job and maybe just needs to be reinforced in that experience and that knowledge, and needs to know that your child will love you no matter what, and that actually children have oftentimes positive feelings about this experience as well when they talk about it as an adult. So it's something that the parent shouldn't really have anxiety about. In other words, I don't think the parent should ever feel that this is an abuse or neglect situation. But they should feel comfortable that they can reach out to get help for their child.
In the United States, Gail, what policy changes do we need to make to better support these caregiving children and their families?
Well, as I've said, there's really very little out there for kids to support them. Very few resources, information, any of the kinds of programs that they have elsewhere. So we are working to try to, first of all, get much more public awareness of this issue, the fact that there are these kids out there and that they need support. And then secondly, to say, okay, how do we get the healthcare system involved and how do we get the school system involved? And what we'd like to do is to have some demonstration programs that actually demonstrate that it's possible to help teachers recognize who these kids are and then have support programs for them in the schools, and also have the healthcare system, the nurse or the doctor, understand that there are these kids out there and how we can reach out to support them. So that's really along the lines of how we'd like to get some government support, for example, in starting the demonstration programs, and then support through the school systems and healthcare system.
Not to mention the need for somebody to help lift some of this caregiving burden off of the kids.
That's a whole other issue, isn't it? Because that really says that our healthcare system really doesn't have a way of responding to these parents or grandparents. And we know that. And particularly if people are above poverty level, it's very difficult to get assistance. Where do they turn to get somebody to come in, for example, during the day or in the evening to help them so that the child doesn't have to do it?
So the child can be a child.
So the child can be a child, yes.
When
you talk to policy people, they are completely unaware. Say, oh, I had no idea of the numbers. They just haven't picked up on this at all.
So we need more publicity.
We need
to
a lot more
people know.
Public awareness that there are these kids out there. And for example, in the UK and Australia, they have programs for teachers to help them recognize how these kids might be in their classroom. And maybe if this child is falling asleep at his desk, it's not just because he was up watching TV late, but it's because he was up in the middle of the night caring for a parent, for example.
Can you give us some examples of some of the kinds of programs?
In the UK and Australia, they have literally hundreds of programs for these kids in the schools. Most of them will be things like lunchtime support groups, or they will have meetings where they'll get together to talk about a specific topic, like how to help transfer somebody without hurting your back. They have summertime programs where they will have camps, and they either have them with the parent who comes along, and then they have the parents and kids interact in a recreational situation, or sometimes they'll have weekend camps where they'll have somebody who stays and takes care of the parent, and the kids get together and have a good time on the weekend. So they have a lot of programs. I mean, literally hundreds of those programs. The other thing they have is a lot of online support. So the major caregiver organizations in the UK and Australia have significant websites for young carers, they call them. And they'll have chat rooms for those kids. And they'll have FAQs, you know, frequently asked questions, or the kids can go online and ask a question of a physician or something so they can get answers. They have very robust web support to these kids in those other countries.
Unfortunately, we have to wrap up at this point, but Gail, what resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to pursue further some of the issues that we've been discussing?
I think the MS Society is a good place to start. The Alzheimer's Association chapters are also looking in to young caregiver support groups for people who have early onset. So in other words, a parent who's in his 40s or 50s who gets Alzheimer's, who has kids who are still in elementary or high school. So those are two groups to turn to. So we need to have that kind of training for teachers to help them begin to be aware of the kids as well.
Well, you have certainly done a wonderful job making us aware of this problem. So, Gail Gibson Hunt, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of The Little Book, a collection of stories and articles, parenting tips and resources for all parents and caregivers, especially those who love and care for children and teens with special needs. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show number 310. Please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Tell us what station you're listening to if you can. Since we air all over the world, it's fun to know where you're tuning in. Our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, is available in all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents Perspective, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. At the site, you can even hear a show at any time. Just scroll down to the topic or guest of your choice and click onto the words Listen to Podcast below. At the end of our program, we often thank individuals or foundations for their generous donations that help with the cost of producing Parents Perspective programs. Parents Perspective is a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. Today it is our turn to thank you, our listeners, for your tax-deductible contributions to our annual fundraising campaign. Please send your checks or money orders to Parents Perspective Incorporated, Post Office Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015. Thank you for helping us to continue to work for you. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.